So I'm going to start out. Last time I had stated Weinberg's theorem, and I'm going to start out by giving the proof. So Weinberg's theorem is the statement that on superhorizon scales, so if the wave number is much smaller than the co-moving horizon, that the helicity zero equations of motion of the metric degrees of freedom plus matter, where matter could be anything reasonable, and I'll try to say what reasonable means, define that a bit better, have a generic solution, the adiabatic mode, which starts out like this, where the dot dot dots mean plus terms that are of higher order in k over ah, where lambda is a constant in time, it can depend on k, that you're allowed to choose, and then alpha is determined in terms of lambda by solving this differential equation. There's an anisotropic stress term here, which is going to always be zero for us. Okay. So the proof is based on, and then we checked that in single field slow roll inflation, where we know the equations of motion, we know the dynamics, that on the basis of mode counting, this is the only solution, that it agrees with what we had before. And we checked that for perfect fluids, where there are many degrees of freedom, the initial conditions look like this mode. All right. So the proof is based on the observation that Einstein's equations have more gauge symmetries at zero wave number than they do at non-zero wave number. So let me just ask the question. And this is all going to be a Newtonian gauge. Let me remind you that in Newtonian gauge, means that the helicity zero metric components B parallel and H B longitudinal and B longitudinal are zero. The metric component I call A is relabeled phi, and the metric component that I called HT for one third the trace is relabeled minus psi. It's conventional to use notation in which when you fix a particular gauge, you rename the non-zero components of the metric, just so that if you have a bunch of formulas lying around that are only true in a particular gauge, you can just read off what gauge they apply in. Okay. So first I want to ask, which gauge symmetries leave the metric in Newtonian gauge? So if I ask this question at non-zero k, the answer is none. So at non-zero k, what I'm supposing is that all components of the metric have a spatial dependence of the form e to the I k dot x. And I'm asking how those components transform under a gauge transformation, which is also has spatial dependence proportional to e to the I k dot x. Oh, sorry. Alpha, beta, so at non-zero wave number, the Newtonian gauge means that these two components of the metric are zero, and at non-zero k, they transform like this. And so if the gauge transformation leaves both of these zero, then beta had to be zero, and so did alpha. So there are no gauge transformations that leave the metric in Newtonian gauge. That's really just a statement that at non-zero k, the Newtonian gauge conditions have removed all of the gauge symmetry. But at wave number zero, there are lots. So you'll notice that these k's go away. And if I write the gauge transformation out in real space.
The form of the gauge, if I write out the gauge transformation properties of the metric, the way that I originally derived them before going to Fourier space and taking the SVT decomposition, then it looks like this. JJ minus. Now, if I ask if alpha and beta, if I ask the question, if alpha and beta I are allowed to be arbitrary functions of x and t, and I want to preserve I have a set of metric fluctuations which are at zero wave number, meaning all components of the metric are functions of time alone. Then I ask, what's the most general function alpha of x and beta I of x that preserves that k equals 0 condition, leaves b equal to 0, and allows hij to get a component proportional to delta ij, then the answer is the most general thing you can have is alpha can be an arbitrary function of time, and beta can be a dilation. Beta can be minus lambda times xi. Such a gauge transformation, here I get 0, here I also get 0, so the time-space part of the metric stays 0. And here, I do pick up something non-zero, but it's proportional to delta ij. So if I started with a set of metric fluctuations which were a k equals 0 Newtonian gauge, k equals 0 fluctuations in Newtonian gauge, then those properties would be preserved by such a gauge transformation. So there's sort of an infinite dimensional gauge symmetry at k equals 0 because this is a free function of time. Notice that the potentials, if I apply this gauge transformation, then the Newtonian potentials do transform. Phi goes to phi minus alpha dot, and psi goes to psi plus h alpha minus lambda. But the metric stays in Newtonian gauge. If we apply the same gauge transformation to a k equals 0 configuration of the matter fields, the proof of Weinberg's theorem is going to not assume anything about the equations of motion, about the physics of the matter fields, aside from overall gauge invariance. So something that's always true is that if I were to start with suppose I start with no fluctuations in the metric and no fluctuations in the matter fields, and I apply this gauge transformation, then that will give me a set of fluctuations in the metric and a set of fluctuations in the matter field. So if I apply this gauge transformation to the matter field, I'll get matter fields, I'll get some mode. For example, if the matter fields are scalar fields, then I'll get this. They transform like this under gauge transformations. If they're perfect fluids, then they would transform like this, and so on. And so if I start with no fluctuations in either the metric or the matter fields, and I apply this gauge transformation, then I'll get a solution to the k equals 0 solution equations of motion. Of course, this is just a gauge mode. It has no, it's an apparent solution to the equations of motion, but it's gauge equivalent to the unperturbed background. But nevertheless, it must be formally true that if I apply this, if I write down this k equals, this gauge transformation at k equals 0, that it does solve all the equations of motion. So now, the next question you can ask is, if I just think of the equations of motion perturbatively in K over AH. And I know I have a solution at K equals 0. Can I extend the solution to non-zero K? Just by perturbing fields order by order in K over AH. If the answer is yes, so this solution at K equals 0 that I described is physically uninteresting. It's just a gauge mode. But we showed that at non-zero K, the Newtonian gauge has no gauge modes. So any solution of this type at K equals 0 that can be successfully extended by perturbation theory to non-zero K will not be a gauge mode. It'll be some real physical solution of the equations of motion. So you might think that the answer is always yes. Something must be wrong with this. Something must be wrong with the statement because it seems to suggest that there's an infinite family of solutions of the equation of motion, the equations of motion at non-zero k. Whereas we know that the number of independent solutions is always the number of degrees of freedom for a first order set of differential equations. But this is often the case for a set of differential equations. For example, if we just ignore metric fluctuations and look at the equations of motion in the matter sector, this will probably be true. And indeed, it's an assumption in the proof of Weinberg's theorem that this is the case in the matter sector. For example, you know, if I take the matter sector with metric fluctuations neglected. Suppose, for example, that the matter sector was single field inflation. Then the equation of motion of the inflaton with no metric fluctuations, without all the weird GR corrections, can be written this way, where I've just moved the terms with, we derived a longer formula before with lots more terms proportional to metric fluctuations. But without those, I can write the equation of motion of the inflaton fluctuation delta phi this way, where I've organized the equation so that terms of order k squared are on the are on one side, and terms that are zeroth order and k are on the other side. So if I started with some solution to this equation of motion that worked to zeroth order in k, if I had delta phi some order k to the zero piece, then there would just be a formal perturbation theory procedure where I plug the order zero piece in on both sides. And by assumption, it satisfies the equation of motion to zeroth order in k. So whatever amount the equation fails by at order k squared, say, will be a source on the right-hand side. And then this differential operator on the left-hand side, if I have an arbitrary source here on the right-hand side, I can always solve it. I can always integrate this differential equation to correct delta phi so that the differential equation holds at order k squared. And then repeat the procedure to solve it in order k to the fourth, and so on. And
one question: k equal to zero is, in some sense, a very special mode, right? Because it just corresponds to the perturbation smeared over the entire space. So why can't we just absorb this in the background field?
You can, right? So at k equals zero, that's exactly what's happening. I mean, this is a pure gauge mode that's actually, you know, just equivalent to. It's not even a real change in the background. It's just a change in coordinates in the same background.
So why would you expect that we can actually have that symmetry that we have for k equal to 0 and apply this to something which is like a generic perturbation?
In general, it's going to turn out to be the case that you cannot take a gauge mode at k equals 0 and extend it to non-zero k. I mean, something seems physically wrong with it. But it's actually a priori, I think, unclear what fails. Because it kind of seems like, you know, if I just think about it a little, that, you know, any differential equation, if it's satisfied to zeroth order in k, I can always sort of, if k is small enough, I can always sort of do perturbation theory to solve it at higher order. But as you say, that statement is physically fishy, so something must be wrong with it, and I'll explain what's wrong with it in a second. Another case where you could, where this would work, if the matter sector consisted of a bunch of perfect fluids and I ignored metric fluctuations again, then it's formally true that if I have a solution to the equations of motion at non-zero k, that I can extend it by perturbation theory, the equations of motion would just look like this. Turned off all the potentials. I also haven't written scattering terms, but they wouldn't change the arguments. So, all I'm really saying here is that you can just organize the equations so that there are zero powers of k on one side and positive powers of k on the other. If I have some solution, delta j of t and v sub j of t, that solves these equations at zeroth order in k, then there'll be no problem for small k, the right-hand side. The equations will fail by some amount proportional to 1 power of k. I'll put that on the right-hand side, and there'll be no problem integrating to correct delta j at first order in k, and so on. Okay. So, in the matter sector, it appears to be the case empirically, and indeed this is an assumption in Weinberg's theorem, that there would be no problem, just as a statement about formal solutions to differential equations, extending a solution to the equations of motion at 0k to non-zero k. The problem comes when you look at Einstein's equations. Sorry, guys, I'm a little disorganized. Okay. Let me just start by writing out all of Einstein's equations, just so we have them on a board somewhere, in Newtonian gauge in SVT notation. So they are. So the metric degrees of freedom in Newtonian gauge are these potentials phi and psi, which are equal to each other in the absence of anisotropic stress. But Weinberg's theorem is true even if there is anisotropic stress. I guess that's relevant. Because we're using Weinberg's theorem to connect inflation to the radiation dominant universe via the adiabatic mode. And we know that there's no anisotropic stress on either end, but we don't really know what the physics is between inflation and radiation domination. Maybe there was anisotropic stress there. So it's sort of important that the theorem still works with anisotropic stress. OK, so the situation is that we have Einstein's equations. These are equations with the two Newtonian gauge metric degrees of freedom on the left-hand side, phi and psi, and the stress energy of the matter sector on the right-hand side. Einstein's equations appear to be overdetermined because there are four equations with only two fields. But the way that this always works is that the matter sector, there's a consistency condition that the matter sector has to satisfy, which is that stress energy is conserved. And if we write out the condition of stress energy conservation, that is a identity between vectors, and the zero component and the helicity zero spatial component will give two equations, the continuity and Navier-Stokes equations, which are redundant, partially redundant with Einstein's equations, so that there are only there are secretly only two non-redundant equations here. Okay, and the situation is that we're starting with this gauge mode at k equals zero, and we're trying to extend it order by order in k. And so we can say that we have some partial picture of this, of a solution. Is that minus lambda or plus lambda? Minus lambda. We have a solution which we know works at k equals zero, and we're trying to extend it. And b and pi are 0 to 0th order in k. Now, you can indeed check that just from the k equals 0 part, which is all that I know yet so far about this hypothetical solution to the equations of motion, that the equations are satisfied at k equals 0. You have to, this follows, this is actually kind of a non-trivial calculation, like you have to use Friedman's equations, you have to use stress energy conservation in the matter sector. But as sort of a check on our understanding so far, if I plug in this phi, psi, delta p, and delta rho, v, pi, into the equations, and just cross off terms with positive powers of k, then one can check that the equation, Einstein's equations are satisfied. But what's happened is that some of the equations have gone away completely, so to speak, at non-zero k. Like this equation just reads 0 equals 0. So we weren't really checking anything. In fact, you can see that there's kind of a... this equation is going to impose some sort of constraints on the solution, which are new. For example, just to take the simplest case where there's no anisotropic stress, if we were thinking about the adiabatic mode during inflation or during a perfect fluid phase of the universe, then the right-hand side here would have to be 0. And phi and psi would have to be equal. And we've already written down, we haven't solved for higher powers of k here. But we've already written down phi and psi as 0th order in k. So just the requirement that these be equal to 0th order in k is placing some constraint on the mode. And so if phi and psi were equal, then this would have to be, this would be a necessary condition. We haven't shown that it's sufficient. But a necessary condition to extend the gauge mode at 0k to out to non-zero k. In the presence of anisotropic stress, this becomes... so that's where this differential equation in Weinberg's theorem on alpha is coming from. Up until now, alpha was a free function of time, and that's okay if you... that's okay for purposes of just defining the gauge mode at k equals 0. But in order to, one necessary condition to extend the gauge mode to non-zero k is that this differential equation be satisfied. Now, I want to claim that this is the only condition that needs to be satisfied, just as a formal statement about this set of differential equations in order to start doing perturbation theory in K over AH. And the reason that is true is that I can, because I know that the equations of motion in the matter sector imply stress energy conservation, and that stress energy conservation, which is equivalent to, if I assume stress energy conservation, I can derive any two of Einstein's equations from any other two. Then I can cross off two of the equations on the list. I'm going to cross off these two. So then I can organize things so that the equations of motion have, I can organize this guy so that the k squared, I'll move this term over here, I'll move the k squared over here, so that I can do perturbation theory in powers of k. And here what's happened is that I've solved the equation to leading order in k. See, what is true is that we're assuming that you can always solve the Einstein's equations plus the matter equations can always be solved perturbatively, provided that you've solved them to leading order in K. But leading order in K here actually meant order K squared. So that was an equation that did not appear at zeroth order in K. It only appears, that equation only shows up at non-zero K, and it gives us this non-trivial constraint. But it is a formal property of Einstein's equations that since you can take two of the equations away, if stress energy is conserved, which is implied by the equations of motion, then if this condition is satisfied, then you've solved all the equations to leading order in K, and then you can just start doing perturbation theory to get higher powers. So that is basically how the proof of Weinberg's theorem works. Now, Weinberg's theorem, oh yeah, one little thing that I didn't say is that, so that's the proof. One little thing, let me write down a few more, like delta rho is minus rho bar alpha. All the fields in the matter sector transform the same way that they would if you had a pure gauge mode, to lowest order in K, but then there are more terms here that we didn't try to compute that will depend on the equations of motion. One thing that I didn't say, when I stated the theorem before, I said that there were two solutions. There's an adiabatic solution and an adiabatic decaying solution. That statement is actually hidden in the way that I've written things here, because this differential equation for alpha, let's see, so this differential equation can be reorganized so that it's, this differential equation can be integrated. And it looks like this. It's an equivalent way of stating the condition on alpha. I didn't specify the lower limit on the integral here. And indeed, you could take two solutions with the same lambda and different lower limits on the integral and a difference them, and you'd have another adiabatic solution, and that's the adiabatic decaying mode. So the adiabatic decaying mode is just the mode where lambda is equal to zero, and this alpha, if I were to difference the integral with two different initial times, I would just get a constant here multiplying the 1 over a. So the adiabatic decaying mode is just given by the same set of formulas, but with lambda equal to zero and alpha proportional to 1 over a. So because that's falling off, that's redshifting away in a, for example, during inflation, when a is an exponentially increasing function of time, you know, this mode exponentially decreases. And so coming out of inflation, it's just rapidly suppressed, and we just assume that the universe is in the pure adiabatic mode or adiabatic growing mode,
which is the case where I take this, the lower limit here to be infinite minus infinity. Okay. So Weinberg's theorem is really powerful because it tells us the complete behavior of the fluctuations before horizon crossing. So I took a little break from talking about the matter fluctuations in order to talk about Weinberg's theorem. Before that break, we were talking about this picture where we had, this is 1 over AH, and this is scale factor A, where you should pretend that there's a log scale on both axes. So I've got inflation here. Got radiation domination here. I got matter domination, lambda domination. Let's suppose that I'm interested in a mode that crosses the horizon during matter domination. So it became a superhorizon mode at some point during inflation. It was superhorizon all the way through radiation domination, through recombination, the formation of the CMB, and then became subhorizon again later. Weinberg's theorem applies here, all the way up until horizon crossing, until a Hubble time or so before horizon crossing. So this is the period. Actually, I can draw the arrow farther back. I can draw it all the way back here. This is the period when the K mode is in the adiabatic solution. Adiabatic solution means that there's some constant value of lambda, which is actually the same thing as the zeta that we defined during inflation. This zeta sort of comes up in different places and has different interpretations. So I like to notationally distinguish. Zeta is one of the metric fluctuations that we define during single field inflation. And then I use lambda when I'm talking about the dilation that appears in the proof of Weinberg's theorem. But a little calculation shows that they're equal. If you work out the adiabatic mode during inflation, you'll see that what we're calling lambda in the proof of Weinberg's theorem, in the specific case of single field inflation, it's the thing that we called zeta before. So adiabatic means that during this entire history, even through the formation of the CMB, the fluctuations in every species were controlled by zeta, by the curvature perturbation set during inflation. And they're just given by this general set of formulas. It's only after horizon crossing that the three species, like the dark matter and baryons and the photons, can sort of evolve independently, and everything isn't just determined by zeta. The intuition here is that once a mode is superhorizon, it's indistinguishable from a shift in parameters of the background. Like, there's no way, if I have a mode, here's some fluctuation in, say, the baryon abundance. If it has very long wavelength, and this is the causal horizon, there's no way for this part of the mode to know that there's a perturbation and that we're not just living in a universe with a slightly different omega baryon. It can't talk to this underdense region and start evolving. Now, another thing we knew when we left off our discussion of matter fluctuations in the late universe, we were analyzing behavior of matter fluctuations in a different regime, namely the subhorizon limit, where K is much larger than AH. We analyzed that case and found that during this period, so the solution that we had before applied from horizon crossing to horizon crossing, the only assumption was the subhorizon limit. I guess we also assumed matter domination. But that's the case here for a mode that I've assumed crossed the horizon during matter domination. So under those assumptions, we found that delta was just some constant
A constant can depend on k, but not on time. Time's a function of time, which we named the growth function, d. Let me write an equation for delta over here, too, as well. Delta is just rho. This is the matter over density. Delta here is just rho matter dot times alpha. Now, one thing that we haven't worked out yet is, times zeta. There's sort of an order one region that we haven't analyzed. So we don't know how a mode of a given amplitude here, how that amplitude determines the C that sets the initial conditions in this epoch, that we don't know what coefficient to put in front of the D of A. So that's the bit that I'll analyze next. So it turns out the way this cosmological perturbation theory works is that you sort of start building up statements that are true in different regimes, and then once you've built up enough statements, you can kind of connect everything together. So we have one regime where the adiabatic theorem applies. We have one regime where the equations of motion were simple and we could solve them completely. So another statement is that there's a conservation law. It's very important. Very important quantity which is conserved in the late universe, called R, which is defined in Newtonian gauge, defined like this. Now, it is a fact that's just easy to check by doing some algebra, that from Einstein's equations, I was going to say and stress energy conservation, but that's implied by Einstein's equations. Derivative of R is given by this expression. This is P dot. Now you might ask the question, I can check this by algebra, but is there some sort of deeper reason for even considering this quantity in the first place or getting this conservation law? There is, but it would be too much of a detour with only 15 minutes left for the entire class. This R actually is one of the metric components in a different gauge, the so-called co-moving gauge. Where this equation appears just directly as one of Einstein's equations. It's a funny aspect of this cosmological perturbation theory that there's sort of no super gauge where everything is sort of most transparent and convenient. In the Newtonian gauge, some things are really clear, like there's this, there's sort of only one, because there's no anisotropic stress, there's only one potential phi, which acts more or less like the familiar Newtonian gravitational potential in the equations of motion. There's a Poisson-like equation. So the Newtonian gauge is really simple. The analysis of the fluctuations in this regime, for example, is the simplest. But then other things like the existence of this conservation law just kind of look like obscure miracles of algebra. And then there's this co-moving gauge with kind of complementary pluses and minuses. I always wanted there to be some sort of Uber gauge where everything was transparent, but it doesn't seem to exist. Anyway, that's where this R really comes from. Now you can see from on the right hand side, I only have pressures and anisotropic stress. This is delta P and P bar. And so the right-hand side is zero during matter domination. Another thing that you can check, again in the Newtonian gauge, this is not so transparent, just a thing that has to be checked, is that it's also zero when the universe is in the adiabatic mode. You can either check that if you plug in the adiabatic mode formulas for delta P, for V, and so on, that you get zero on the right-hand side. Or you can check that if you plug in the adiabatic mode formulas for psi and V, that you get a constant quantity on the, you get a constant value of R. You get lambda, exactly. So during the adiabatic mode, the derivative of R is zero, but a sharper statement is that R is just equal to what we were calling lambda before, or if the adiabatic mode originates in single field inflation, what we were calling zeta when we studied the physics of single field inflation. So the range of times when R is constant is from, I guess it would start here. It starts when the universe is in the adiabatic mode, which is when the inflationary mode crosses the horizon. It extends all the way out. R is still constant because we're either adiabatic or the universe is matter dominated, and stops here. When the universe switches over to being lambda dominated, then background with a cosmological constant dominated background, it does have a mean pressure, so this term turns on and R is no longer constant. But there's this long range of times where R is constant. And so that'll let us connect here and solve for C. So we found so we have this conserved quantity R, which you can check is equal to zeta during the adiabatic initial conditions part of the universe. So I just have to work out a formula for R during the matter-dominated phase. When we found that, so what we currently know there is that delta matter is equal to some constant times this growth function. If you look back at our solution to the equations of motion, so this is during matter domination. When D of A is equal to A, D starts to level off during lambda domination. Another thing we found is that theta was equal to minus delta. This comes from the eigenvector we found. You'll remember there were these two eigenvectors during matter domination. There was the growing mode where delta theta was equal to 1 minus 1 times a, if you want e to the lambda log a, where lambda is equal to 1. Okay. Let's see, we also found that phi, which is the same thing as psi, because there's no anisotropic stress, was equal to this. During matter domination, more generally, there would be an omega matter of A sitting in front here. We know our solution lets us read off all the values of the fields just with this one undetermined coefficient. And so we know that R, which is minus psi minus AH over B parallel, that's AH over KB parallel, comes out to 5 halves times C times the growth function times A squared H squared over K. Well, it was supposed to be constant, and we got d times a squared times h. But during matter domination, h squared is proportional to a to the minus 3, one way of writing it would be to say that h squared during matter domination would be h naught squared, our Hubble constant today, times an omega matter to get the matter density today, times an a to the minus 3 to go back to scale factor a. And so a way of writing r that makes the constantness apparent is to write it as, write this factor on the left-hand side as omega matter h naught squared over k squared. Oh, I lost the, oh, this should have been k squared. Yeah. I lost a k, but this was the only one that I lost. Okay, so we know that setting the r in the initial conditions equal to the r during matter domination, we know that zeta is equal to 5/2 c omega matter h naught squared over k squared. Or in other words, we've solved for the c. So we know, now we know the actual exact prefactor relating the matter fluctuation in the late universe to zeta. It turns out to be 2/5 k squared over omega matter h naught squared times the growth function. This solution applies, if I write the growth function here instead of a, this solution applies through lambda domination as well. So it applies now at redshift 0. Once lambda turns on, it's no longer true that r is constant. You know, that regime has broken down. But we're still in the regime where we know that the matter fluctuation is proportional to this growth function. That regime goes from horizon crossing all the way until the mode re-enters the horizon. The one epoch that's sort of missing here, by the way, is what happens here when the universe becomes lambda-dominated and goes back to being de Sitter. That I don't actually know off the top of my head, because I don't think it would be hard to work out. I just haven't tried. We always analyze data that came from the past light cone, never from the future light cone. So this isn't something that like the blue-collar data analyst needs to know about. But writing the lecture made me sort of curious. Anyway, one thing we were trying to explain, let me translate this to a formula for the matter power spectrum. So we've really derived a formula for the matter power spectrum in terms of cosmological parameters. We have the omega matter and the h naught here. P zeta, in terms of cosmological parameters, is an amplitude, which is a parameter, times 2 pi squared over k cubed, times k to the ns minus 1, where ns is a parameter. So if you give me a set like the Planck parameters, I can tell you exactly what the matter power spectrum is. But there was an assumption, which is that this formula only applies if the mode became subhorizon during matter domination. So it would apply to the low k part of the power spectrum, this formula for P of k, in which P of k is proportional to k to the fourth times P zeta. And P zeta is approximately scale invariant. So down here, the matter power spectrum goes like 1 power of k. It would go as k to the ns, if the primordial power spectrum is not precisely scale invariant, with the prefactor that we computed. This formula applies out to a value of k, call it k equality, applies out to the co-moving wave number, which is equal to the inverse horizon size AH at matter radiation equality. This is
AH evaluated at matter radiation equality, which turns out to be around 0.02 inverse megaparsecs.
And this is one of the things that we were originally, that comes out of this system of differential equations for fluids in the universe that we were trying to explain. The one thing that we haven't explained is why there's a turnover. You know, so far we know that it goes like 1 power of k, and then it just sort of trails off into a question mark. What actually happens is that there is a turnover. If we had more than 5 minutes, the next step would be to analyze why this happens. I mean, roughly the way it works is if the mode crosses, I'll just say, if the mode crosses the horizon during radiation domination, if it sort of wakes up and like feels some evolution during radiation domination, then during radiation domination, the photon pressure is dominating. And photons, because the equations of motion are pressure dominated, you can't have gravitational wells that grow by gravitational collapse. And so this turns out to suppress the potentials by an amount of suppression that's equal to the number of Hubbles between the mode crossing the horizon during radiation domination and matter radiation equality, where this growth factor solution takes over. Roughly what happens is that if a mode is down here, then it gets to stay superhorizon. It doesn't know that there's a radiation-dominated epoch. It gets to stay superhorizon until the universe becomes matter-dominated and the fluctuation can grow gravitationally without pressure stabilization. Whereas a mode out here, a small-scale mode, it wakes up during radiation domination when the pressure in the universe doesn't let it grow gravitationally, and so its amplitude gets suppressed. This isn't hard to work out. The behavior of the fluctuations during radiation domination isn't really any harder to work out than the cases that we did work out. It's just different physics. All right. So we're out of time, so I have to stop here. I want to give some a little bit of postmortem. So I absolutely did not do what I said I was going to do on the first day of class, which was give a class that was sort of centered around data analysis and like computational cosmology. That is because what I thought I would do is sort of talk about the physics of the CMB and large-scale structure. In order for data analysis to be meaningful, you need to have a good sense of the physics that generates the maps that you're trying to analyze, the data that you're trying to analyze. Once I got into it, I found, you know, to really sort of describe it, for one thing, I got a little excited about it and just found myself spontaneously writing long lectures. And for another thing, you know, as physicists, we want to understand it at like a non-hand-waving level, and that just takes a long time. I mean, it easily filled up 3 weeks, and it would probably take 3 more weeks to get to the point where, you know, we really had a detailed understanding of how the CMB peaks are formed. So I don't think that given the 3-week Psi format, a class on cosmological data analysis is actually a good idea. I think my new plan, like for next year, is going to be to just try to flesh this out a little bit more. I think 3 weeks actually is a good length of time for just giving kind of an introduction to the physics of the CMB and large-scale structure. Unfortunately, we're just sort of getting to the good stuff. I mean, it's really fun I think we only had 4 lectures on the physics of the perturbations after inflation. That's only really enough time to sort of set up definitions and work out a few basic things. Like we saw the growth function, the existence of the adiabatic mode, mostly worked out the existence of this peak and the matter power spectrum. My plan for next year would be to try to move some of the inflation preliminary stuff into the first course with coordination with the instructor for that part, and then spend 3 weeks in the second course just doing kind of like a really concentrated, organized class on CMB and large-scale structure physics. Because I was sort of making this up as I went along, I was a little less organized than I probably could have been. Like in hindsight, it would have been probably been good to distribute like a big formula sheet on day one so that you guys could like flip through it during lecture and read off stuff like this so that the equations wouldn't seem to come out of nowhere so much. Let's see. So anyway, that's my plan. I enjoyed giving the class. I actually learned a lot. When you have to write lectures, you like understand fine points that maybe you glossed over that were kind of missing in your understanding before. I am curious to hear how you guys liked it. There'll be some sort of feedback form. It is sometimes hard as the lecturer to get a sense for how helpful the different parts of the class are. In particular, so let me know what you thought of the class, what you think about my plan for next year. In particular, one thing that I'm kind of curious about is whether you guys found the computer problems helpful. I personally find that since the subject is just kind of numerical, it involves a lot of differential equations that you really have to solve numerically. They don't have analytic solutions. It is very helpful in my own understanding to go through the exercise of just putting them on the computer and seeing what happens and just sort of comparing the plots with my own analytic understanding. Let me know what you guys think, whether the computer problems were helpful. Another possible option would be to sort of have like a computer problem option for people that like numerical stuff and an analytic option for people that like pencil and paper calculations better. That's it. Thanks.